Hello and welcome to FinTech Insider Insights. I am Ross Gallagher, and in today's episode, we are asking, how global can Islamic finance become? Islamic finance is an industry sector with faith and ethical practices at its very core. It's also a sector which has moved from a regional niche into a booming industry valued at over $2.88 trillion US dollars, estimated by industry experts. As the majority of the 1.8 billion global Muslim population lives outside of the GCC in Malaysia, which are the main hubs of Islamic finance to date, the industry still has lots of room to expand across the world. So how global is Islamic finance? What are the challenges in its way? And how does the future look? We'll discuss all of this and more in today's show. But first, a brief word from our sponsors.
Let's face it, cards were not designed for online. Payments can take days to settle, hurting customer loyalty, while high fraud, clunky checkouts, and expensive fees means millions in missed revenue. At TrueLayer, we've made instant payments available for businesses across Europe and the UK, so you can cut costs, fight fraud, and get money moving faster. To learn more, visit TrueLayer.com/payments.
FinTech Insider presents After Dark, Ripping Up the Rulebook, a special recording of FinTech Insider live from New York City, and we want you to join us. On Tuesday, May 24th, we'll be looking at DeFi, punk rock, embedded finance and hip-hop, and breaking down how they've all disrupted their industries. Head to 11fs.com/afterdark for all the info and to get your free ticket. That's at 11fs.com/afterdark. See you in New York.
Okay, let's get started. As ever, I am not alone, and I am very lucky to be joined by a panel of amazing guests who can shed some light on all things Islamic finance. First off, I'm joined by Arib Siddiqui, founder and CEO of Kestrel. Arib, welcome to the show. Can you give our audience maybe a brief overview of your background and also the sort of background, the context behind Kestrel?
Sure. Hi, Ross. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. So Kestrel is the Muslim money app. We're an app that helps Muslims who want to grow their wealth without having to compromise on their beliefs. We do that by helping Muslims at every stage of the personal financial journey, from building a budget using our open banking technology to automatically saving into pots of money to actually providing our users with halal investment options as well on top of that. Kestrel was born out of a personal frustration that I've lived with my entire life in the UK of not having halal banking and investment solutions. So myself and a friend from university decided to put our heads together and try and do something about that. So fast forward a couple of years later, and now we have two offices in the UK and in Malaysia, and we're serving people in both markets. So that's Kestrel.
Awesome. And it's a really cool proposition with lots of really useful features. So I'm looking forward to sort of pulling on all of your expertise that you've sort of picked up through that journey, Arib. So great to have you on. Also making a very welcome return to FinTech Insider, we have Samim Abedi, Chief Investment Officer at Wahed. Samim, welcome to the show. What can you tell us about yourself and also about Wahed?
Thank you for having us again. Well, Wahed is a Sharia compliant robo advisor with operations in the US, the UK, Malaysia, and many other regions in the world. Our primary goal was to provide access to the retail investor to Sharia compliant investment options in the long only space. In addition to that, we use both third party funds, but we've also launched a few of our own funds and proprietary products. And so we're looking to really rethink the Islamic investment landscape with sort of access in the retail space being our primary tenant.
Awesome. And I know we're going to get into some of the particulars around those sort of Islamic investments as we go through the show. So that's going to be great to have you on. And last but by no means least, we have another welcome return for Naheem Bassa, the Senior Vice President and Head of Strategy and Digital Transformation at Bank Al Jazeera. So Naheem, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us again. Same question to you as our other esteemed guests. Maybe a little bit of background on yourself, just to remind our viewers, and then also on Bank Al Jazeera and what you guys are up to.
Hey, it's great to be back, and Eid Mubarak to all your listeners. Wishing you and your family a prosperous year ahead, and may all your good deeds be rewarded. As you mentioned, it's great to be back. Bank Al Jazeera is a 47-year-old institution in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and is a fully Sharia-compliant boutique bank offering end-to-end financial services, products and services. My role in Bank Al Jazeera is quite far-reaching, ranging from financial plans to digital transformation, market trends, fintechs, but really it's looking at the core purpose of the bank and how we deliver on the promise of enriching lives through financial well-being. This is really exciting for us, as it's at the apex of ESG, environment, society, and governance, digital, and customer needs. So looking forward to today's discussion with the fellow participants.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Naheem. All right, great. Well, look, let's just let's dive straight in. Let's look at that question that we sort of posed in the intro. How global is Islamic finance today? Naheem, maybe I'll stick with you just before we start to go into a little bit more detail around some of the particulars in this space. Maybe you can just give our listeners a sort of very brief explainer for those that might not be all that familiar with Islamic finance, just what it is that we actually mean.
Yeah, great. You know, Islamic banking has probably steadily gained traction for over the last 50 years, right? I think there are over 100 Islamic financial institutions globally. Recent developments in the UK have seen new fintechs, right, such as Wahed, Kestrel, who we have on the call today, Nomo, and Alif. These fintechs have arisen from the US, Malaysia, Kuwait, and even the UK themselves, indicating the growing demand, right, and appetite for Islamic banks. So it's quite a booming sector, right? But what exactly is Islamic banking, right? Is it only for Muslims? Is it 100% Sharia? Often the term Sharia compliant is to denote the ethical standards, right? And the transparency around your products and services offered as Islamic, right? So Islamic at its core is really about being interest-free, asset-based, and ethically driven, right? And it has many similarities with other religions. So it's not just for Muslims. To make it real for people, rather than quoting a level of interest, Sharia-compliant banks will quote you an expected profit rate. And this is precisely because Islam teaches you that money has no intrinsic value, and so you cannot charge or earn interest on it. Instead, the money has to be put to work, which I think is very hot topic, right, if you think about money and investments and savings globally, right? And you get a share of that profit. This is different to commercial banks, which are, you know, are probably more interest-based and don't have many preconditions into which industry they support or invest in. Sharia-compliant banks, for example, cannot invest in gambling or alcohol firms. Hopefully that was a short and brief introduction to Islamic banking.
No, I think that was a perfect introduction to Islamic finance, and I think the principles that sort of that govern the space. And there's, Naheem, already you've given us, I think, several different jumping off points. Samim, I'm interested maybe in your opinion. I know Naheem mentioned the sort of, is it for Muslims, is it not for Muslims? And maybe a little bit more broadly, actually, how would you describe the sort of the average Islamic finance customer, maybe sort of in 2022? And maybe has that changed as time's gone on?
Yeah, sure. I think it's important to sort of dissect the term and break it down into component parts, because often it's used as an umbrella term to mean a lot of different things that actually might not really be similar at all. So in our space, it obviously means Islamic investment options, right? Investing in companies and equities or other asset classes that are permissible, just to sort of keep it high level. On the institutional space or the banking space, you know, obviously there's a sort of a punitive view on interest-based revenue. Lending is very punitive in the space. And then contractually in sort of the commerce space, it refers to sort of having clear terms in contracts, settlement terms, physical assets, asset-based leasing sort of agreements. So it's all these things sort of coupled together in this umbrella of Islamic finance. So, you know, it depends who you are. If I'm a corporate client, it might refer to sort of a banking relationship or an underwriting relationship on corporate debt. If I'm a retail investor, it might refer to the type of companies I'm trying to invest in. More often than not, I think we get sort of caught up in the minutiae of the actual rules and the screens. But high level, these aren't really rules for the sake of being difficult. They're really trying to solve a problem. In the investment space, very simply, you know, and we'll get into the ESG a little bit later and what conventional secular ESG is trying to do. But in our space, you know, very basically, if I can't own something in a retail brick and mortar fashion, I probably shouldn't generate investment returns from those equities as well, right? It's a very analogous thing. If I'm a shareholder in a company, but I couldn't actually open that sort of company in real life, right? Those things tend to have sort of an inherent friction in them. So high level, I think that it means a bunch of different things, and it's probably more an umbrella term than that's it. So an Islamic finance client can be, you know, a pension, a sovereign wealth fund, a retail investor, someone that has a deposit base and a savings base. And I think all these things are connected, where in conventional banks, if I had to sum it up, it would be deposits and lending. In Islamic finance space, I think the savings, the investments, and the contractual side of things are all sort of linked in that ecosystem.
Yeah, no, again, such helpful context. I think, Ariba, I know that you guys are sort of playing in the space with a variety of these different types of products, right? Halal sort of savings products, and sort of looking at the sort of ethical investment space. I'm keen to understand maybe you mentioned in your intro some of the frustrations that you had. What are some of the problems that you guys are looking to solve for your customers, for your consumers?
Yeah, I think the thing which really jumped out at me, which Samim mentioned as well, is I think in the past, large Islamic banks have really focused on that minutia of the detail as to, you know, this is exactly what is halal and this is what is haram. When in reality, you're forgetting about what the real value to the end customer is meant to be. People want to be able to buy houses affordably without feeling like they want to compromise on their beliefs. People want to be able to go to university and take a loan out without feeling like, you know, they're not adhering to their religion. They're feeling like they're having to compromise on something. And that, I think, is being lost in the conversation, or has been lost with some of the older Islamic banks which have existed in the UK. Growing up for me, when it came to opening up a bank account, there were two major Islamic banks in the UK. But looking at them, it was just sort of a real turn off looking at their websites. They didn't really have an app to worth speaking of. The user experience was very, very poor. And it just felt like, compared to some of the other conventional banks, Barclays, NatWest, I felt like I was giving up something or paying for something because of my religion. Some people jokingly refer to it as the Muslim tax, which you have to pay by going down that route. So that was one aspect. When talking to our users, there is more of a fundamental trust issue as well, where because people get caught up in the, well, you know, instead of interest, we're calling it profit, we're doing this, we're doing that. A lot of people have a misunderstanding that, oh, Islamic banks are really just taking specifically haram or forbidding concepts like interest and relabeling them, calling it by another name, and they're charging us more for that. So I think in reality, it's really not the case at all. Things are being structured very, very differently. And I think the messaging isn't coming across at all. So I think it's a trust factor. I think it's a user experience problem. And also, at the end of the day, a cost factor as well, where things just tend to be far too expensive for the typical retail consumer.
I'm interested in that point. Is that because just on the back end, because of everything that we've just talked about, those processes, settlement, et cetera, are they just more complex? And so they ultimately work out as more expensive. So maybe I'll come to you on that one.
Yeah, you know, complex maybe from a theoretical standpoint, but I think the key term here is sort of relevance, right? What is the relevance to the average user? And, you know, we get into the academic arguments and sort of the jurisprudence, but it's a bit like constitutional law or something that would be debated in Parliament in the UK. You know, it's very probably interesting for the people in the space. It's probably very nuanced, and there's centuries of evolution and academic thought and something to how we got to this point. But for a retail user and your average person, quote unquote, really the issues that matter is how do I generate wealth from sort of a job that's okay? How do I save things? And if we're talking about, for example, investments, right? If you have $50,000 in investments at 10% a year, that $5,000 is a potential return. Or you could potentially save $50,000 a year off a $120,000 job. Savings is a lot more relevant to you than investments, let's say. But, you know, getting a house, compounding wealth, and then passing wealth down to your children, these are the things people are really focused on. So I think we've maybe focused too much on sort of the under the hood and you know, the complexities of the theoretical things, versus the practicality and the relevance. I think relevance is really the key term here. How do we make this applicable to most people?
Yeah, I think that's such a lovely point. It's a really nice way to flip it. Nahim, I can see that you're sort of nodding away in absolute agreement. So keen to bring you in.
Yeah, I fully agree with what my fellow colleagues have said, right? Firstly, I don't think there's an average customer, right? I think that term is gone. What I can say is that there's probably like three types that are emerging, right? Especially in Saudi Arabia. There's this up-and-coming, vibrant female market, right? You'll see a lot more females entering the workforce, right? So they have their own special needs and demands, right? There's this more mature middle market, right? You know, how do I get a home loan? How do I find a home for my families, right? And a generation, I think, aiming to look at wealth transfer and management for future generations, including building or leaving a legacy, right? What I can say with utmost conviction is that the market is growing, right, in Islamic finance, right? And it's a lot more focused on the underserved, right, in this market. And so when I say underserved, I'm talking about, it's not about having money, right, or not having money. It's about saying, people ask, I mean, I get asked every day, where should I invest? Should I invest in the stock market? Should I invest in locally or foreign, right, property or a real estate fund, right? And it's those sort of needs that we need to really get into.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think that's really nice. So I'm keen to sort of dive into the market's growing. We can see from the panelists that we've got on the show, we're seeing disruption. We're starting to see innovation. I'm keen, maybe Arib, I'll bring you in first, and then Samim, we can look at the US. But Arib, how are you seeing the UK market sort of evolve, innovate in this space, and what are some of the bigger changes?
Yeah, so I think since 2018, 2019, and during lockdown as well, there's been an explosion of the term Islamic fintech because of all of these new tech-focused companies that are coming out there. Ourselves, we started in late 2019, early 2020. And since then, there's been a whole explosion of Islamic digital banks, people coming out with a card linked to an app, people coming up with crowdfunding organizations where you can invest into property or into small businesses as a group. So it's definitely grown significantly. I think in terms of real innovation, though, unfortunately, sometimes with Islamic fintech or Islamic finance in general, you see a trend whereby sometimes it's a concept which is maybe 2, 3, 4, even 5 years old, and they're slapping the Islamic label on top of it, where it's a business model which has been tried and tested in the conventional model, and then now they're just trying to put an Islamic twist on it and putting it out there for Muslims. And sometimes it works, but sometimes I think that's yet to be proven. I think a really good example are Islamic digital banks and coming out with a card. So for example, with Kestrel, our original business model was, well, let's do a sort of Monzo for Muslims. We'll come out with a debit card, we'll put it out there, and we'll say, you know, this is your Islamic digital bank. When we started testing that in beta with our original users, the feedback that was coming back was, this is a nice to have, but in reality, it's going to take a lot to move me away from my Barclays, from my HSBC, or even from my Monzo account, which I'm very happy using. I'm using a current account and not collecting any interest. If I'm getting interest, I'm giving it away to charity. So I need something else. And ultimately, what I'm trying to do is grow my wealth, right? Just exactly the concept we talked about already. How do I get that house? How do I give money to my children? How do I achieve those goals quicker? And that's basically time and time again, what we were coming back to. So I think we're starting to see more and more innovation on that side of things. Wahid, of course, leading the charge. And they've been huge inspirations for us at Kestrel as well.
Excellent. No, I think that segues us probably, quite neatly into the challenges section. So if we're quite happy just to sort of jump straight in, maybe Samim, I'll just come to you first in terms of picking up on some of the points that we've just made around some of those consumer challenges and maybe some kind of thoughts that you have in that space.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, we can't talk about investment in our space without talking about literacy. And I think primarily our community, when I say our community, you know, it depends on the region we're talking about. In the UK, for example, it's large portions of the South Asian community, but their wealth has really been trifurcated between sort of cash under the mattress, real estate, and private businesses, right? This is how they've sort of generated wealth, and people are married to concepts that have worked for them historically. So, you know, we'll see the older generation saying, just buy property. Perhaps we missed that wave, right? In sort of the younger demographic, we missed that sort of boom period. But that said, the public market side is a little more opaque, a little more abstract, and people don't really know. And I do think there's a bit of a tendency in our communities by sort of the explosion of WhatsApp groups on crypto and things of sort of, how can I hit a home run and triple my money overnight? And I think the element of patience and long-term and focus in terms of the compounding side is something that's actually very similar to your normal conventional investor in our space. And so that's always a challenge, right? Because people in our space do tend to chase returns. Many of us haven't seen a down market, and we're only 4 months in this year, and people are hurting. And, you know, other periods in history have lasted many years. So, you know, that can really break the sentiment of a consumer in terms of not believing in something. But if you kind of keep your eyes towards the 5-10 year mark, things tend to be okay, right? We don't know where things are going tomorrow, but we know eventually it's up and to the right. And just kind of reinforcing that. And I think education and emotional temperament actually have a lot more value than necessarily being sort of a brilliant investor that can kind of dive in and out of things. And so, you know, teaching customers that patience, teaching customers that trust are very important in the space. I do think, you know, it's interesting for us because we have a seat from the US, the UK, other areas of Europe, India, Malaysia. So you tend to see the tendencies of Muslims in different regions, right? And so, you know, some regions are a lot more kind of open and they see the bigger picture. Other ones sort of are focused on this moral absolutism. And if, you know, if we look at the example of a stock, there's probably no conventional company listed on an exchange that doesn't hold deposits in an interest-bearing account, right? So by that lens, people would say, well, I can't touch any of this stuff. And so a lot of the scholarly guidelines have really taught us thresholds and not to look at things in absolutes, right? Even if we look at the analogy of tahur and water and purification, right? If something impures in a glass of water, you probably won't drink it. If it's in a lake, it probably doesn't really move the needle too much. So teaching people to think in holistic, big picture items and having patience, I think, is always the challenge in the conventional, but we're no exception to those trends.
Yeah, that point about patience is such an interesting one. And I think especially when you think in terms of, like, you know, the social media generation, we're all sort of like used to getting instant feedback, instant outcomes. And actually, we're sort of moving, I would say, probably in the wrong direction with regards to patience in sort of many respects. Naheem, I'm keen to sort of bring you in and get your thoughts on, some of these challenges. And I know, again, you were sort of very much engaging with the other panelists' points.
Yeah, I think they 100% are on the money, right? I think there's also another lens, you know, if you're coming from a banking perspective, right, and you're thinking, okay, I want to start up a Islamic fintech or I want to start up an Islamic digital-only bank, right? I think, you know, firstly, you've got some good, strong tailwinds in your favor, right? But I think some of the key challenges are, number one, right, you almost have to balance the Sharia-compliant regulations that the colleagues were talking about, right, which mean you need a Sharia board comprised of Islamic scholars, right, which, you know, you have to be really diligent in how you pick and the ones that are really understand this concept, right? And then you almost have to marry it up to the standard banking regulations. So you've got that overhead and that friction point that you need to address, right? On the other hand, you know, health approaches ends up being more robust, right? But you'll need the deep knowledge and expertise, right? I think secondly, and I think we've touched on this earlier, right? There's a lot of education, right, that needs to happen, whether it's financial literacy or even just the positioning of Islamic banking, right, or Islamic financial services, right, along that value chain. First, you don't have to be Muslim, and also, what are you seeking to do, right? I think that's the second biggest challenge, I think, that exists out there at this moment in time.
Awesome. Yeah, such interesting insights. I think one of the challenges as well that we wanted to look at was around those for women in the Islamic finance space. So to find out about this, we reached out to Samina Akram, managing partner of Samak Ethical Finance, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today, but did send us this clip.
The challenges women face in the Islamic finance space are really no different from the challenges women face in the conventional finance space. Around 2005, I entered the Islamic finance sector. I was heading the Islamic finance wealth management platform at Merrill Lynch. Now, when I first entered the industry, I would attend events or read articles, and you would really hardly see any female role models. However, over the years, government and wider industry-focused initiatives, especially in countries like Malaysia and some parts of the Middle East, we are actually now beginning to see a slow change. My own challenges as a female banker and seeing the obstacles other women faced inspired me to launch the world's first forum focused on women empowerment for our sector. We started with 30 key members And today we have over 10,000 members in over 30 countries, with several global financial firms supporting us.
Yeah, so it's an interesting point, sort of tying it back, I suppose, to the world of traditional finance and some of the challenges that we've seen there. Naheem, I think you mentioned the opportunities that are being presented by sort of women coming into the workplace. I think you were talking about it more in terms of like capturing that in terms of market share and being able to service those customers. But again, how important is it to be able to bring in alternative perspectives into the sort of banking environment in terms of actually helping to service those customers as well?
Yeah, I think it's the nail on the head, right? I think there's a lot of pent-up demand, right, and needs, right, that need to be met. Typically, right, to open up a bank account, previously you'd have to get a male family member to do that, right? So you can really see that hurdle, and then you'd get the advice from your uncle, your brother, etc. Which not to say it's bad, it's just that you obviously want to take some control in having the attendance over your money, right? How you're earning it, how you're saving, how you're investing in it, right? I think there's also this other challenge, right, about, you know, what exactly is make something halal haram, right? And you can get into the nitty-gritty of it, right? Especially since most of the scholarly texts are in Arabic, right? Or a published Arabic journal. So it's not really widely disseminated. It's not really there that everybody can get into. I think if you look at some of the regulators, they've done some good work in this part to enable these access to this product. I'm talking specifically in the Middle East. If you look at the UAE, you look at Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, right? I think they've done some very good work in enabling access to these products and services to these new markets. And I think there's two growing markets, like you said. Number one is the female segment, primarily because they're going to be an increasing part of the workforce. If you look at the Saudi 2030 vision, for example, right, it's really booming. This is some really aspirational targets, and that comes with its own set of ambitious driver. But you're also getting a lot more, I would say, SME businesses, which are also female-owned, right, entering the market. So you're getting into another segment, right, more on the corporate institutional banking side, right? And the third one, I think, is around, there's still a lot of work being developed by the migrant labor force here, right? So how do you enable access for them, right? That's really key. And a lot of the population comes from the Southeast Asian markets, right, which are very much into this ethical Islamic banking proposition, because that's how they've been raised.
Yeah. And Arif, I'm interested to understand just from your perspective. I know we've sort of talked about the intricacies of setting up a Sharia council to sort of certify that the products and the services being offered are in fact Sharia compliant. What's your experience around that and trying to do that in a sort of market like the UK, where that's not necessarily, I suppose, the sort of expected norm?
So I'll be honest, we use Amana Advisors, which is a really good Sharia advisory consulting service led by Mufti Faraz Adam. He is very well known in the Islamic finance and fintech space specifically, known for weighing in on issues from crypto to the metaverse to NFTs, to all that kind of good stuff. Whenever we are coming up with a new product, whether it's our budgeting tool or our Kestrel savings pots or eggs, as we call them, or investment marketplace, the delays have always been from a technical perspective. You know, whatever we're planning, we always have to times by two, and that's in reality how long it's going to take. The Sharia screening and the Sharia certification aspect of it is often the quickest kind of process on it. I think it comes from how experienced the Sharia advisor is, how many cases they've seen as well. If it's something entirely new and foreign to them, they'll have to take a lot of time researching, getting other opinions. So I think that there are different kinds of Sharia certification, and more fintechs and finance organizations are moving towards those who are pretty much in the know and are able to weigh in on these kinds of things.
Yeah. And then Samim, final word to you in this section. I know you mentioned previously about sort of not necessarily dealing in absolute and sort of acknowledging some of the nuance that sits in this space. I'm keen to understand your perception around sort of regulation, I guess particularly regulation in markets like the US as an example. How comfortable are they regulating Islamic compliant financial products and services, and how much of a barrier this potentially is or isn't?
No, I think the regulations, I mean, so much of our pitch to clients centers around trust, right? And so I think having some sort of deposit insurance in the UK and the US actually enhances the credibility of a product and doesn't necessarily detract from it. In terms of them being able to regulate kind of the Sharia space, I think that requires in-house experts to be able to really speak to the nuances of it. So I think there is some acknowledgement that, you know, that's not necessarily their forte to really delve into issues of legal opinion on certain matters, you know, particularly from the regulators. But they do want to make sure you are doing what you're saying you're going to do, right? That there's a consistent alignment there. So far I've seen that's really the focus on regulation. It's not necessarily say, well, you decided that 5% was an impermissible threshold, but, you know, the SEC coming at you saying, but what about this hadith? I think that's kind of outside their wheelhouse right now, nor do I think they're interested in really getting into the minutiae of faith-based investing guidelines. For us, you know, the regulation isn't necessarily an issue on the Sharia compliance space. It's, to me, Sharia compliance is really, you know, one of the adage and idioms in Islam is sort of forbid the bad and promote the good. And I think the Sharia screens really just forbid the bad. They're kind of a bare minimum, right? You get rid of the things you can't do, but you're not necessarily talking about, well, what is good, right? What is something that we should do? So I think the challenge for us is thinking beyond kind of the paradigm of don't do this, don't do that, because I think from a body of text perspective, probably, you know, I've had scholars tell me 5 to 10% of really are the tenets of the religion are really legalistic. The rest are really kind of, you know, a higher level, or I would say sort of a little more open to interpretation and stuff like that. But I think we get so focused on kind of don't do this, do this, that it's not such a mechanical exercise. There's a bigger picture of what are you trying to achieve here? You know, the focus is on speculation and not being able to day trade and stuff like that isn't trying to be difficult. It's trying to say, don't gamble with your money on things that are uncertain, right? We don't want you to ruin yourself. We talk about addictions to sort of drugs and other substances, but the gambling addictions, I think, is something we sweep under the rug a little bit. So there is a wisdom to this, and there is a problem it's trying to solve. And I think we do ourselves a disservice a little bit to kind of focus on like, do this, do that, because it's meant to give you kind of guiding posts, not necessarily always kind of step-by-step things, right? These are new territories. And so I'll say that on the regulation piece.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. And it starts to probably move us into some of the opportunity space. But I think that's, you know, the fact that conversation needs to be fluid and that you need to sort of, from the regulatory perspective, accepting that this is where your expertise is, but inviting sort of input to inform on those other things, I think is key. Okay, so we're just going to take a quick pause here and we will be back very shortly.
Did you know that the majority of people are investing in cryptocurrency through a taxable account when they could be using an IRA, that's an individual retirement account, and avoiding or deferring those taxes? With Alto Crypto IRA, you can invest in crypto without tax headaches, creating a free account in only minutes. Choose from over 150 coins and invest with as little as $10. That's right, only 10 bucks. No setup charges and no account fees. To open an Alto Crypto IRA with as little as $10, just go to altoira.com/insider. That's altoira.com/insider.
Okay, let's move on from the present challenges and let's look at what the future may hold for Islamic finance. So, Samim, it seems natural to sort of bring you back in here. We touched on it earlier, and I know we sort of teased that we would talk about this. What's your view in terms of what the growing ESG movement, what can sort of Islamic finance learn from that?
Yeah, I think kind of like a lot of the other elements of Islamic finance, being at the banking, being at the structuring, underwriting piece, I think, you know, it's beneficial and it behooves us to sort of acknowledge wider trends going on, but it also, you know, benefit us not to be too reactionary and trying to sort of emulate something, right? I think the ESG, I was at JP Morgan for many years and ESG always came up, but there was never really a consensus in the conventional space of what it meant. But what does it mean? A, what does it mean? And B, what are you trying to achieve with ESG? If you ask some fund managers, they'll say, well, I will only invest in companies that are ESG. And, you know, excluding something like a major oil company from your portfolio, like Exxon's not really going to care. I don't think that'll change corporate behavior. Other people will say, well, no, we're going to buy companies that aren't ESG, and we're really trying to force them on the right way through proxy voting and corporate actions, right? But the literature remains to be seen on whether that's effective in the larger cap space, maybe in the smaller companies. So I think the conventional space is also grappling with this question. So for us, I don't think we should be too quick to just rush to emulate and join the conversation, but really define it on our terms. To me, the Islamic finance space is actually quite easier to understand than this, because if I can't generate revenue from a liquor store, I shouldn't own a liquor stock and compound my wealth there. I'm not necessarily making a statement on changing the behavior of those companies or diminishing some sort of market liquidity. I'm saying I want to align my income and my livelihood with my compounding of my livelihood and my wealth, and bringing those two things into sync, I think, is our goal. Whether we can kind of do things that are more, more proactive, I think, is something we are trying to do. You know, we personally launched a fund that has ESG aware screens on it. We get to see companies that are, you know, through a third-party data source called Repris, maybe engage in some more egregious practices. And so it's not that necessarily we may be changing their behavior, but it's that we don't really want to benefit from returns from a company that doesn't have practices that are conscientious and ethical. And really, for us, it's sort of aligning the internal with the external, and remains to be seen whether we're going to extrapolate that and making bigger changes on it. But I think for us, we always sort of start introspectively and internally, and then we kind of move outward. So that's the way I'm thinking about that space for us right now.
Yeah, no, and it's super nice. And I think, you know, Samim, you're exactly right. In many respects, Islamic finance is a lot more straightforward and easier to understand. Naheem, keen to bring you in again, because I can see that you're vigorously in agreement.
Yeah. I've just been doing a lot of work in this ESG space, right, recently, and I've been speaking to some of my network globally around it. And I mean, ESG is effectively growing dramatically, I think, globally and especially in the Middle East, right? We've got the Saudi 2030 vision, we've got the Saudi Green Initiative, right, which is all around, you know, transforming, moving in sustainability. I mean, the Crown Prince also recently put about $80 billion into the PIF to invest in non-oil industries, which I expected to grow about 3.5 to 4%, right? That's just on the non-oil side. In addition, I think we're seeing a lot more investors, fund managers, and consumers demanding a lot more of us, right, as institutions, right, the financial services, Islamic institutions. I always talk about my mum, right? My mum asked me about these things, right? So I have to explain to her, right, in a way that a non-financial services person is working it, right? But I think what we're really careful of doing is avoiding greenwashing. You know, in the discussion so far, right, I think it's more about firstly making a contribution, right, because there's no common understanding around ESG besides maybe GRI, maybe the European banking standards around it. Locally, we have Tadawul and the Six Principles, which is the stock exchange, but you also got the central bank and their sustainability risk and climate risk principles, right? So I think it's about, let's just start, right? Just make, you know, an active step forward in the right way, get that understanding going. And I think the second thing, right, especially in the region, right, it's about tapping into the social movement that is happening, right, in terms of this reshaping of the fabric of society here, right? I mean, we mentioned female participation in the economy, right, and how we can enable this, right? So I think it's about really boiling down to the nuts and bolts that ESG has a lot of commonality with Islamic banking, especially on the trust and transparency side, right? So, you know, I always say use the mum test, right? Make it logical, make it easy to understand, and I think you'll be successful.
Yeah, and I would argue that, I mean, those Sharia-compliant products offer a really compelling sort of value case for consumers as we all become more conscious of sort of our impact on society, etc. Areeb, we've touched on this a little bit already around the importance of trust, the importance of transparency education in terms of bringing the potential to bring Islamic finances to people that haven't always had access, unbanked, underbanked. I'm keen to sort of hear your thoughts on, how we're doing that, how we continue to do that, and how that sort of evolves from here.
Absolutely. So I think with Kestrel, we've been really successful amongst two core user groups right now. Young professional Muslims aged 22 to mid-30s who are starting out in their careers. They're starting to make a bit of money. They might be first, second, third generation. And they're trying to align their faith and their beliefs with their financial objectives and their goals in life. And we also do quite well with students, 18 to 22, who are trying to, you know, plan out and chart out their futures and get onto a job that they believe pays them well. And also they feel like they're adhering to their religion. The thing that I found is that in this space, you cannot operate like some traditional organizations. You have to be in as many different avenues in front of your users as possible. So weirdly, bizarrely, in ways I would never have imagined, making TikTok videos and me doing a silly dance or going viral and talking about stuff, making Instagram posts and carousels and going on stories. And it does much, much better than, say, taking out a billboard in some cases or getting some posters on the tube, all things that we've experimented with. And for some reason, people tend to trust that more. They feel like they have more of an insight as to who these people are who are running this company, telling more about the story of, you know, how I myself faced this problem my whole life. And then I decided to come together with a friend, try and do something about this and get that out there. It kind of says something to the influencer generation where people want to know the face behind the company. But that's really how trust seems to be being formed at the moment. There's also an element of education, absolutely. So, you know, we have a lot of buzzwords and expressions and things that we use at Kestrel, like invest, but tie your camel first, which is a very well-known phrase in Islam calling, which talks about how you should trust in God, trust in Allah, but tie your camel first, which means make all preparations beforehand. And, you know, we did that to introduce the idea of budgeting and then saving for your short-term goals, building an emergency fund, all of these good aspects before you get obsessed with thinking about investing and investing into crypto, which is often what young people want to do when they come to us. So I think trust and the idea of gaining trust is about moving very, very quickly in ways that you might not have anticipated before.
That's really nice to me.
And I hope this isn't too tangential, but I wanted to kind of reframe the conversation. You know, we started this off with talking about, well, the Muslim market, the Islamic finance industry is growing, right? And what do we mean it's growing, really? Do we mean that Muslims are becoming more educated and generating more wealth in Western countries, and so now they're a bigger part of Western consumer behavior? Because a fifth of the world's population has always been there, right? So they didn't just pop out of nowhere and suddenly we need to cater to this demographic. Really, at the turn of the 21st century, we're either talking about regions that had struggled to shift from industrial production to service industry and maybe sort of the educational side, or they were impacted by colonialism and then sort of they're trying to get out of that and really develop their countries now. And so, you know, when we think about it, we think about access and catering to the rest of the world. But we're also talking about people that are becoming more and more central to their societies and to their communities in the West. And so now we have to pay attention to them because they have a lot of money that we have to kind of cater to. And so the conversation is the same with sort of the women in the GCC. You know, it's half the population, right? So it's something worth looking at now because there's power there. So I just want to reframe in terms of, you know, it's growing and it's growing for certain reasons. The democratization of sort of mobile apps and the internet and giving people access. They don't have to go through necessarily gatekeeping institutions or personnel in the traditional family. They sort of have a direct line to it, right? And so I just want to kind of reframe that growth and expansion of this industry because it didn't come from nowhere. It was just people weren't catered to, and it didn't make sense for a lot of people to invest the resources in the R&D into these regions. You know, a lot of the banks didn't bother. Maybe they'd have a Dubai office or an office sort of in the GCC, but they didn't really care about, you know, expanding into Malaysia or Indonesia, for example. So I think we are fortunate through some of our platforms to be able to cater to these demographics a little more directly. And so that's why we're seeing the trends we're seeing.
Yeah, no, it's a really key point, actually. And, you know, similar to your point on access, hopefully, as we continue to sort of innovate in this space, we can continue to service more and more of those sort of unbanked and underbanked populations. We've more or less come to the end, but what I'd love to do is sort of quickly go sort of one by one and just get a really quick sort of view from each one of you around what you're sort of optimistic about as we sort of stand here today with regards to Islamic finance. So, Naheem, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think firstly, right, I think hopefully what I envision for Islamic finance is that it's more than a niche, right? It's about, you know, the unbanked, the underserved, right? Whether it's about existing products today, right, so enabling that access to it, or whether it's about, you know, buy now, pay later in microfinancing, especially for the migrant labor force, including new segments into the saving cycles, right? I think that's going to be really huge. But I really think it's about how people are living their lives, right, and what they aspire to be in Islamic finance is very wholesome, right, very clean, right, and it really addresses, you know, the real values and wants of customers. I mean, in Saudi, right, I think we've got 2 to 3 new digital banks that have just come in, right, just to address some of these needs, right, and the last one which have gone to unicorn status, and there's like 150 fintechs here at this moment in time. So I think there's this mass movement, right, of trying to get Islamic finance more broader, more people to understand it, more engagement, right, into the broader economy, right? And I think that it's an exciting place to be, right? We all also looking for talent, right? So if you want a place to work and do some cool things, please inbox me at any time.
Awesome. Nice, Naheem. Thank you. Arib, let's go to you. Same question.
Yeah, I think the explosion of Islamic fintechs today is starting to lead to new opportunities for collaboration in two spaces. So first of all, collaboration between the new fintechs and the old guard of Islamic banks that have existed for a few decades now is something that I think I'm really, really excited about, where they have the capital and they have sometimes the brand presence, where we newer fintechs don't always have that. Whereas as fintechs, we have the technical know-how, we can move agilely, and sometimes we have the trust of users that they don't have. So for example, in Malaysia, we're now working with one of the biggest Islamic banks over there to white label our solution to offer it as a digital app for the first time to their retail customers, which I think is really going to transform the relationship and the state of play for these banks out there. But also we're seeing collaborations between Islamic fintechs and just conventional fintechs or conventional organizations. So some of the people who are housed on our marketplace are not specifically known for being Sharia compliant, but they do just happen to be so. So for example, Stepladder, which sets up saving circles for communities and allows them to save towards a house deposit in a structure which many people from certain communities know as committees or what, there's like 1,000 names for this kind of structure, or Way Home, which is a gradual home ownership scheme. These are all things which just happen to be Sharia compliant, but they're now finding a market within the Muslim space, which they never anticipated for before, and we can facilitate making that happen. So I think it's all about collaboration and working together to help ultimately the end user.
I love that, Arib. Thank you. And Sameen, final word to you.
Sure. Thank you. I would sum up my optimism in 3 points. One is because we're much of our population centered around developing economies, we have huge demographic tailwinds behind us in terms of growing working age populations, whereas Japan and much of developed Europe and the US sort of has a shrinking working age population. And so we have demographic tailwinds and with that education and up and coming entrepreneurship. The second piece of it is, you know, there's no longer kind of this gatekeeping culture of you have to go through an established Islamic institution to be Islamically, you know, relevant or Sharia compliant. There's many independent institutions to get certified, and the access to, you know, funding, SME funding, or even sort of angel funding or venture funding has now been proliferated. And, you know, obviously some governments have also gotten on board with helping promote entrepreneurship in their countries. So, you know, the demographic tailwinds, the access to financing and the culture of entrepreneurism. The third thing I'm optimistic about is that, you know, anywhere kind of Muslims exist in the US or the UK, they tend to be some of the most educated people and professionals and sort of active members of their society that aren't merely reclusive, but are actively involved in their communities, but also sort of dig their feet in and kind of know who they are. So I'm optimistic about what I'm seeing in the US and Europe as far as how our community is behaving and how educated and how active and engaged they are civically. But I will say the thing that encompasses all of this is you have to lead with excellence. It's not merely enough to be legal from an ethical perspective. Nobody ever bought something because it was permissible. You know, they bought something because it worked and it was excellent and it made their lives easier. And so I think the Sharia compliance of this has to be like a kind of a no-brainer, a duh comment. Like, obviously it's Sharia compliant, but beyond that, it's excellent. It makes everybody's lives easier. And by the way, that's not just Muslims. And so I think you widen your scope and suddenly you multiply your market opportunity 5x. So it's pragmatic, but it's also, I think, the way we should do business. It should no longer mean that if something's a Muslim or Islamic business, that it is sub-professional or there's a Muslim tax to kind of bring this conversation full circle, but rather that it means something else. It means a level of excellence that consumers should be able to expect.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I think, and it's the perfect way to end, actually, because there is lots to be optimistic about, lots to be excited about in terms of where this space goes from here, but then also useful just to sound a sort of note of caution that says, actually, yeah, this needs to be done in a particular way if we're going to realize that. So I think perfect way to wrap up. And that does wrap up today's discussion. So thank you all so much for joining me. Let's go around the room and just sort of give us an idea of where people can find out more about you guys and your companies. Samim, let's start with you this time.
Sure. If you want more information, please go to wahidinvest.com and you can visit our pages for disclaimers, disclosures on our products, our applications, and our funds.
Awesome. Thanks, Samim. Arif?
Sure. You can head over to kestrel.io to find out all about how to download Kestrel and what it could do for you. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me at Arif Siddiqui on LinkedIn as well.
Excellent. And Naheem?
You can find me at naheem.bassa on LinkedIn, Twitter, every basically social media site, and bankeldzero.com on the website, on our app, and all social media sites. Hopefully this will help for listeners today, and thanks for having me.
Awesome. My pleasure as always. And you can find me at RossGallagher07 on Twitter. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you've heard, please do subscribe. Don't forget to leave a review. It does really help us to make it better, and it helps others to find the show. As always, we'd encourage you to join the conversation. Do just find us on social media, search for 11FS or FinTech Insider, or email podcast@11FS.com. Thanks very much. Goodbye.